offering our most loving pranams at Bhagwan's lotus feet. Dear listeners, we welcome you to this week's episode of Afternoon Satsang. As always, joining you live from our studios at Prashanti Nilayam, this is Prem, and with me is Brother Arvind. And we are here to continue our discussion on the beautiful conversations recorded by Dr. John Hislop, one of Swami's devotees from the United States. We've been going through these conversations. As we have seen, it meanders through many, many important topics, from profound to mundane. And we are in the middle of a discussion which has been very, very profound. There was a discussion on Dvaita, on Vishishta Dvaita. Now it is coming to something which is very, very dear to us, where Dr. Hislop starts asking questions relating to Swami and Swami's characteristics and Swami's personality. And as we all know, there is much to learn merely by observing Swami, and it's going to be a fascinating discussion where he's going to ask a question and Swami is going to explain some of his mundane looking expressions and interactions with all of us. I think with that brief introduction, let's invite Arvind and let's start today's conversations with Bhagwan Sri Satya Sai Baba. Sairam Arvind.
Sairam Prem and Sairam to all our listeners. As Prem said, it is an interesting conversation here because he asks questions based on Swami's personality and the way Swami is leading his life. Let's dive in straight away to the question, because Hislop says, please excuse a question that may seem rude. Swami seems to have different moods. What does this mean? You know, till now their conversation has been about how Swami is unaffected by everything. He is actually in a very stable and equanimous state. So Hislop is now saying that Swami says that, but Swami has moods. We see Swami getting angry. We see Swami smiling. We see Swami, even crying on different occasions. So, like any other human being, you too have all your moods. So, though I may appear rude, I'm asking this question because I'm very eager to know the answer. That's what seems to be Hislop's motivation in asking this. Swami gives a very beautiful reply. Swami says, a boat glides over the flood, but does not allow the flood to enter it. Just as one is at peace in a boat into which no water comes, no worries or concerns enter into Baba's state of bliss. But ordinary men do not do the same as Baba. They allow the water, all sorts of worries and concerns, to enter the boat, and there is no happiness, no bliss, no peace of mind. Baba's bliss is ever present regardless of the world. This analogy is very, very beautiful, because often worldly existence or mundane existence is compared to the Bhavasagara, meaning the ocean of misery or the ocean of travails and difficulties. And also ocean, because like in the ocean we have waves which go up and down, we have ups and downs in life. So in that, you know, often when we sing the Guru Paduka Stotram also, we consider the Guru and the Guru's feet as the boat. Naukai Tabhyam Guru Bhakti Dabhyam, meaning you are like the boat in this Bhavasagara. You are the one who takes us across this ocean of joys and suffering, and safely you deposit us at the other shore. So Swami is saying, for the successful sailing of the boat, you have to ensure that no water from the ocean enters the boat. Otherwise, you sink in the ocean, you sink in Bhavasagara. So too Swami is saying, like the boat is in the ocean, but the ocean is not in the boat, every person has to be in the world, but should ensure that the world does not get into him or her.
Right. I think this is an analogy which Swami gives very often. And Swami would also speak about worldliness itself. Right. Mm. Here Swami is speaking about anger, and generally, as you were saying, worldliness itself, Swami would say, it's like you are in the world, but let not the world be in you. And I think when we had the discussion about anger, we had spoken about Swami's anger, and we had seen how Swami would say this. It's something that I put on, something that I use as a tool. And Swami would say that can be done only when you are above the senses, when you are in complete control over your mind and senses. And the difference between Swami and us is we come under the grip of anger, under the grip of all the other qualities which are within the mind, which we talk of as the flaws of the mind. And we've spoken about this. And many, many incidents were narrated where Swami's anger was typically worn in the sense that we could see how quickly he could switch, which is not something that we are capable of. I think just a couple of days back, I was listening to a devotee who was explaining, who was narrating this incident. Apparently, it happened in the portico, and he was a witness. It happened on two occasions. When once he saw that Swami came up to one of the lecturers who was sitting on the portico, and Swami was very upset with him for something. Swami told him, "Why did you do this?" And Swami, you know, gave him a piece of his mind. And at the end of it, this lecturer got up and he pleaded forgiveness, and he said, "Swami, I will not do that again. I promise you, I will ensure I never do that again." I didn't know that Swami doesn't like this. So Swami said, "Okay, beware," and Swami walks off. So this is the first scene he had seen, the first time he is seeing Swami so angry. And he was saying that a few months later, he was in the same place in the portico, and apparently this lecturer had repeated that mistake for whatever reason. And he said Swami came out and Swami was livid. He had never seen Swami so angry, and he was saying that we were all sitting in the portico, and if Swami were to close his eyes for long enough, he would get up and run away. That's how angry Swami was. Like, they couldn't look at Swami. Swami's eyes were red and Swami was puffing and fuming, and he was so angry, and he was speaking at the top of his voice. Everybody till the end of the portico could hear Swami. And at the end of it, Swami said, "Get up and get out of here." In English, Swami said, "Get up and get out." And Swami said, "Don't ever show your face again to me." Right? And I mean, this was definitely not appearing like Swami pretending to be angry. Swami was really angry. And finally, this devotee actually got up. Right? And apparently, Swami stepped back to took two steps behind, thinking that probably he's taking Padmanamaskar, and Swami didn't want to give him that. You know, that was how angry Swami was. And then finally he said, "Okay, Swami, I'll leave." Swami said, "Yes, you have to. Get out." Right? And then Swami again repeated, "Get out and never show your face again to me." And the scene was so tensed, everybody was wondering what is going to happen and is he going to really get up and walk away. And this devotee looks at Swami and he says, "Swami, I will leave, but one condition. Tell me or point out to me one place where I can go to where you will not see my face again." Okay. And all the people sitting in the portico were saying, the moment this person said that, Swami's expression completely changed. He was absolutely back to normal, and he said it's impossible for a person who is under the grip of anger to cool down like that.
In fact, telling such things will anger you even more.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, in fact, he was saying that when Swami was shouting at him, this person was quiet. And he had an expressionless look on his face, and Swami was getting even more infuriated because of that. And when this person said that, Swami completely cooled down, and then Swami looked around and Swami said, "See, even at such crisis, if you're able to hold on to the thought that Swami is divine, that is true devotion." Swami said, because it's like the biggest crisis. You've given up everything in your life. You've come here. You've settled here. You're working in Swami's institutions. You want to be here all your life. And this is like big time crisis, right? And Swami said, even at such a situation, you have not forgotten for a moment whom you're interacting with. And Swami said, that shows how stable you are in devotion. And Swami said, if that devotion is there, the other mistakes can always be corrected. And Swami forgave him literally. But the point I was referring to that incident is the absolute control that Swami had over anger. I think more than one occasion Swami has showed that, you know, he never hates anybody, he never gets upset with anybody, but sometimes it's required. As Swami would say, sometimes modulation of the voice is necessary to ensure that what you're saying reaches home, right?
As you said, it's about using all these as tools. In fact, it's not just about anger which Swami uses as a tool. I feel even the attachment and love that Swami displays. You know, when Swami tells that, "If you leave me and go, what will happen?" There have been many people to whom Swami has said that. It would be foolish on our part to think that Swami is attached to this person and Swami can't live without this person. It is not like that. Just as anger is a tool to correct a person, so too is attachment a tool to correct a person. Swami is neither angry, Swami is neither attached. And I feel that is the beauty we get to observe when the Lord comes as an avatar. You know, when the Master is there in the physical form, we get to learn how we should lead our lives. Because, like Swami continues to say, you know, I'll read that out and then tell what I wanted to share. Swami is saying, "Consider that each month Baba must meet the expense budget of hundreds and thousands of rupees. On his shoulders rest all the affairs of the school, the ashram, the people within his physical circle, the interviews, the petitions, the correspondence, the problems. All that at the body level. At the same time, on the mental level, Baba is with all those who yearn for God, no matter in what area of the world, saints, yogis, rishis, spiritual aspirants, everywhere, watching them, guiding them, fostering every movement of heart or mind towards God. So, if somebody says that, you know, easy for Swami to tell all this, sitting on his royal throne, it is not the condition. You know, if we try to empathize with Swami and put ourselves in his place, I really feel from a physical, worldly standpoint, it was a miserable life possibly to lead, you know, with absolutely no freedom. You know, God is supposed to be the expression or epitome of freedom. But look at the restrictions and limitations that Swami imposed on his physical frame in order to, you know, for the sake of his devotees, for the sake of all of us. Right from the morning, if you look at his schedule, you know, at 4:30, whether you like it or not, you are woken up by the loud chants of the Vedam, you know. If you have gone to bed late at night for some reason or whatever. No, I'm just looking at it from a very purely worldly point of view. 4:30, there is loud waking up. After that, there's Nagar Sankirtan. You can forget sleeping after 4:30 in the morning. And then you have to get up, have your breakfast, get ready, and you come out, and what's waiting for you? Hundreds and thousands of people to dump their worries and problems on you. Just imagine that, okay? One may always think that Swami is lucky because Swami is blessed. Swami is having thousands of people waiting on him. They're waiting on him for what? To pour their woes and problems. You know, as he walks out, starts his darshan from the lady's side, start from there. From the first lady onward, there are letters waiting. And what kind of letters? You know, going statistically by the letters that I have myself written, I know that majority of the time these are problem-laden letters. Either, you know, health issues or wealth issues or relationship issues, career issues, or Swami, that has not happened, this desire has not got fulfilled. And Swami collects. He's supposed to collect. And hundreds and thousands of letters, at the end of it, he goes into the interview room, then you have a concentrated and focused problem session, because that's called the interview, where you sit and what happens in the interview, again the same thing, different chosen people come and sit and pour out their woes and troubles, and listen to all that, then go back to your residence and read all the letters that are there, filled with problems, so your whole morning is filled with problems, you know, that is your work. Every day we get up and go to office and we say, oh, so many problems are there, we have to solve this. Swami's office didn't have any holiday, no public holidays, no festival holidays, no Sundays. And he had to work double shift. So in that sense, Swami's life was filled with so many troubles and problems, and it was, I mean, no freedom. You have beautiful lawns, you can't walk. You have so many, you know, people say there are so many cars. You have cars, but you can't go out for a drive. I feel the Lord in his love on us, he shows that you can have all these limitations and yet be beaming with joy and bliss, because bliss is not something external, bliss is something that is internal. I think that is the message that we need to learn from his life when he says, my life is my message.
Absolutely. In fact, you know, many people who have not observed Swami closely might not know the level of involvement that Swami had when it came to his institutions. And even when we joined, probably that was a time when the institutions were mature enough to take care of themselves, and you know, they had very senior lecturers and heads who were there in charge of each one of them. But even then, we have seen whenever Swami would start something new, for instance, I think when we were students, Swami started the Whitefield Super Speciality Hospital. The Mirpuri College of Music was set up.
The Gram Seva.
The Gram Seva as a program starts. And all of this, we would have seen the amount of energy that Swami would put into, not energy merely to enthuse the people working, but also the amount of planning that Swami will get involved to in, you know, talking about Gram Seva. I was just telling this to one of our listeners the other day when we were talking about it. You know, whenever you talk about Swami's attention to detail, we always say that, you know, Swami was very important, Swami was a perfectionist, Swami always thought that everything should be done to the, you know, the last detail. However much that might be true, I think we often forget that Swami's attention to detail comes from Swami's sensitivity to the person he is serving. Right? When you talk about the Gram Seva, I still recall Mrs. Ratanlal telling how that puliora or whatever you call that chitranam used to go from the heap which was being packed to send to villagers. A casserole of that will go to Swami's table, which means every day Swami will check how it is being done. Is it getting spoiled? Is it too spicy or is it too less spicy? Because Swami is very particular about that. And the first few days, Swami asked them to get that leaf and asked them to measure out how much rice they're going to pack. And Swami said, no, this is not enough. And then Swami explained why. See, these are people who work in the fields. They eat more than you. So don't put how much you would like to eat. Put a little more than that. And then Swami said, see, this should be their lunch. They should not feel like after this, they should find something else to eat.
Hmm.
So keep that in mind. You know, the way Swami would go into such details, he did not do all these things. But Swami was saying that, you know, as you were saying, it's completely independent. The work that you do, the pressures that are there on you, the commitments that you have around you, the kind of time and the restrictions and the disciplines which you have to follow, none of this can actually put a cap on your bliss if you choose to be blissful. I think that's something which Swami said sometime back. Swami said, you know, these are not restrictions on my bliss, and that's why I'm always happy. And
in fact, that is what Swami is going to tell next also, because Swami says, Baba is untouched by all this. His bliss is constant, unchanging. Even outwardly, his bliss is constant, not just inward. Even though it may appear that he is angry, impatient, aloof or distant, the anger is just sound, because the sound of anger is necessary to correct certain situations. In a like fashion, aloofness or distance is just the appropriate role at that time and place. In fact, Baba's love is constant and unchanging, just as his bliss. I remember in one discourse, Swami had mentioned that when it rains, we all celebrate. But then, at times, there are hailstones, hailstones that fall because of certain precipitation conditions. Water freezes into ice and these ice rocks fall along with the rain. Swami says that when there are hailstones, you feel the pain. But if you think a little, you will realize that these hailstones also are the same water. It's just the same water in another form. So too, Swami said, my anger, my aloofness is also my love in another form, that's all. That form may not be pleasing for you, but it is necessary for you, and that's why I give it. You know, when you were talking about that Gram Seva packing rice, normally any human can just say that, you know, delegate this to somebody who is under me, who is my subordinate, and tell, come on, you know, I'm taking care of so many things, can't you do just that much? Should I have to taste that and see? But Swami did it, you know. In the initial days, you know, people would say in the initial days Swami did it. It's not like that. Even till the final days, Swami was so involved. Before the Gram Seva began, there was a Narayan Seva program that would happen in the stadium,
right,
where all would be fed. It was, I think, on the 18th or 20th of November.
Right.
It used to be held. And I got the chance of witnessing one such Narayan Seva, because after that, the next year, the Gram Seva began. During that Narayan Seva, what would happen is the stands that are there, the gents' galleries, under that, there would be huge mats that are placed, because on those mats would be poured these little mounds of rice. The mound of rice would go up to almost 3 to 4 feet. And then it would again be covered by other mats. So the students would come under the galleries, collect this rice, put it into the vessels, and then go and serve the people. And as always, it would begin with Swami inaugurating this. And Swami would himself go and serve all the Narayanas, as we call them. In the beginning, almost one line, he would serve them with both Pulihara as well as the Pongal. So, while the whole world has seen Swami serving Pulihara and Pongal to the people, you know, with his own hands, what I saw that day was something stunning, and there were a lot of people. You know, Swami first came and he entered the section below the gents' galleries. Coconuts were given to him and he broke coconuts as an auspicious beginning to the whole Narayan Seva, sprinkled that coconut water on all the food that was kept. And then, what I saw, you know, it was such a revelation for me, because this was my first year as a student, and, you know, always we have been revering Swami as God, and we think God at the highest level. We see how maybe our politicians or top-notch businessmen, how they are treated. And you feel that God will be treated at an even higher level. Of course, we treat him like that. But what Swami did was amazing. He walked in and as the aarti was done, he walked straight to the mats, picked up two mats, opened them up from two different heaps, just plunged his hand into the food, put it into his mouth and said, yeah, it's good. This was, you know, for me, it was something unthinkable. Swami, you are picking up food which is put on the, you know, it's on the, yeah, of course it's on a mat, but it's on the floor. But Swami was like, it is the same. Narayana Seva means you are feeding the same Narayana. It is the same in, it is the same Lord, you know. It is the same Lord that eats through this body. It is the same Lord that's eating through that body also. And it was not just a theoretical concept because Swami indeed picked up and had that food. It was such a revelation for me and this was in 1999, you know. By this time, Swami is an established avatar, you know. Nobody is going to say anything. But as you said, that is his involvement. That is the way he showed his life is his message. And that's why, you know, we often think that if I want to have a happy life, a comfortable life, it is about living in possibly high society and who will do all this, you know, eating off the floor and all. It is not about that at all. Happiness and bliss is something that is totally disconnected from the world. And Swami is making it very clear that if you are searching for that happiness and bliss in the world, I'm sorry, you're sadly mistaken. And it just reminds me of a chinnakatha that Swami would say that a person is searching for a ring that he has lost. And two, three people come and ask him what has happened. He says, I have lost my ring. And oh, they're very sad for him. They also start helping him. But after searching for long, they say, sir, do you remember exactly where you dropped the ring? Because we have been searching for quite some time, but I've not been able to find it. And that then he says, yeah, I dropped it over there in that corner. Then they tell him, then why are you searching for the ring here? He says, no, that corner it is dark. Here there is a light. That's why I'm searching for it here. And this story Swami narrated and Swami then said, man is being foolish like that. He is searching for happiness where he will not find it. Simply because, you know, we think that money, we think that position, we think that relationships, we think that career gives joy and we search for it there, not realizing that joy is within us. We are searching for it in the wrong place. And Swami makes it amply clear over here that in spite of whatever loaded schedule I have, how much ever busy I am, all the problems that I have, I'm absolutely blissful. Nothing touches the bliss because I don't derive bliss from those. In fact, I ensure that my bliss permeates everything. Everything that I do, everything that I interact with, everything that I touch in my day-to-day physical life also.
This point where Swami is saying that I'm involved in all of these activities and at the same time I'm also involved in, you know, rewarding the saints and yogis and the rishis. Yeah, in a sense it talks about the physical and the spiritual aspects of Swami. But even in the physical, Swami would, you would see Swami doing both of these things. You know, he's the one who is actually getting involved in the last detail of the preparation. At the same time, he's also the one who is rewarding somebody who is working like that or who is doing whatever work they're doing as an offering to Swami. Mm-hmm. And I remember all of these teachers who were trained by Swami in taking care of guests, the hospitality department, invariably, whenever there's a conference or whenever there's a major celebration, when the VIPs had to be taken care of. Swami would have a select group of students and teachers whom he would appoint them and, you know, take care of this. Initially, Swami used to set the trend. You know, Swami would come and Swami would tell them how you have to look for what are the things that you have to ensure that it is there. And they would say that invariably Swami would come, these guest rooms, Swami would come to check himself. And one of the first things Swami would do is Swami will go inside the bathroom and check the flush. Right? And imagine these are devotees who have come to Swami and Swami does not even have to show this kind of hospitality. You know, you are coming to benefit yourself. You come and you stay, right? Mm-hmm. But here is Swami, and that's the detail to which Swami would go. Swami would go and check the flush. Swami would check if the towels are there, the soaps are there.
The switches are working.
And so the teachers who worked with Swami know that, you know, what is the kind of attention to detail that is required if Swami assigns you a task. And one of our teachers were narrating once, I think one of the ministers were expected and Swami was to host them in that Srinivasa guest house where most of the presidents and prime ministers usually stay. Mm. So this teacher and another senior teacher who was again groomed by Swami were assigned the duty of taking care of that particular thing. So they had gone there for a last minute arrangement, and that got delayed. By then, Swami had come for darshan. And Swami had come, Swami called all the students who were involved in the hospitality group, who were serving and all of that. Swami wanted to, you know, kind of call them and brief them or just to inspire them, whatever it is. So Swami had called all of them for an interview. And the word reached the guest house where this teacher and the other senior teacher are doing this
serving.
Work.
Hmm.
And so this teacher turned to the senior and asked, "Sir, should we also go to Mandir? Because Swami is calling the group and we are part of the group." And the senior said, "It would be wonderful if we can go, and that would be nice to be in Swami's interview room. But see, this is a task which Swami has given us. And when Swami comes later in the evening, we should have completed this. So I think it is better we stay here, and I think Swami would appreciate that better if we were to do this and get this ready." So they said, all right, and they continued their work and they finished the whole thing. And they were expecting that Swami would come probably later in the evening or the next morning or something like that. But suddenly they got news, Sevadal came running and they said, "Swami's car is coming." Hmm. So suddenly Swami came to the guest house very casually. And he looked around and Swami asked them, "Do you know why I came?" And they said, "Swami, you must have come to check the whole place." Swami said, no, "I called all the other boys and I noticed that you two were missing.
Mm-hmm.
And I realized that you are here doing the work. So I thought I'll come and, you know, acknowledge that you're doing this work, prioritizing this more than even coming for that chance of an interview." So, you know, here is Swami who is setting the trend of, you know, how you have to get involved in work. At the same time, when you're doing it, the person who is rewarding is also him. You know, Swami is saying the rishis and yogis who are meditating, I'm the one who's taking care of their welfare too. So even physically, we've seen Swami playing this, you know, this entire spectrum of role from the person who is doing everything, at the same time, the person who is rewarding those who are doing everything too.
On that happy note, dear listeners, we'll take a quick little break. And on the other side of the break, we'll continue with this conversation.
Ye thoni anandu re anandu, ye thoni anandu re anandu, ye thoni anandu re anandu. Rupa Sagar to Govindu re, Rupa Sagar to Govindu re, Anandu re, Anandu. Ye to ni Anandu re, Anandu. वाजे ब्रह्मानंद टाई महाराजा से राम वाजे ब्रह्मानंद टाई वाजे ब्रह्मानंद टाई महाराजा से राउड़ी महाराजा से राउड़ी आनंद Anandu re Anandu. Lakshmi Chaturbhuj Dha. लक्ष्मी चतुर्भुज ध्यान प्रसाद घेऊन बाहेर आली लक्ष्मी चतुर्भुज झाली लक्ष्मी चतुर्भुज झाले लक्ष्मी चतुर्भुज झाले आनंद रे आनंद रे आनंद
Welcome back, dear listeners. After that beautiful song, we are here to continue with that discussion. We till now spoke about Swami speaking about how Swami's anger, Hislop asked about Swami's anger, and then Swami also spoke about how, in spite of his commitments, in spite of him being burdened by the mundane affairs of the ashram, of the institution Swami runs, how Swami is constantly in bliss, and Swami spoke about that. The next question that Hislop asks is, he says, Baba has the inconceivable immense task of the universe. How can he afford to spend time talking to people like us? So that's the question he asks. He said, Swami is the avatar. We all know that. Swami is the cosmic master. It seems a bit illogical that Swami spends so much time with individuals, especially saying Hislop is referring to himself. Swami's answer is this. Swami says, Baba with his limitless bodies is everywhere doing the tasks. 1,000 heads, hands, feet. Sahasra Shirisha Purusha, Sahasraksha Sahasrapad. It is just this body that sits here talking to you. That is Baba's omnipresence. The avatar is beyond the five elements. He is the creator. Arjuna was the controller. Krishna was the creator. Science is outside. Wisdom is inside. Man turning outward creates machines. But there his control ends. Witness the three dead astronauts of a few months ago. God is not subject to any limitation. He is the creator of the elements, their modifier, their preserver, their destroyer. So that's the detailed answer that Swami gives. Of course, it goes from the simple to the very, very profound truth which Swami is speaking about. But the very, very simple thing is, the restriction that Swami was the physical, or, you know, Swami's time was those 24 hours that Swami spent, or this time that Swami spent from his waking hour time to the sleeping time. I think that restriction was in our mind. The restriction that Swami was born in 1926 and Swami discarded the physical in 2011. Again, that is a distinction that lies in our mind. From Swami's point of view, there's probably just a continuum of time, and he does not see it like, oh, I'm spending this much time on you and I've spent this much time on the rest. And of course, I think also the point that Swami does not see each one of us as individuals. You know, when Swami says that you and I are one, there is only one, there is no two, you can be sure that Swami is also operating constantly from that point of view, where he does not see, I'm speaking to so-and-so and I'm not speaking to so-and-so. It's eventually the same individual, the same Atma which Swami is speaking to. I mean, I'm not saying that I've understood all this, but the range of that Swami has covered in his answer is like that. Mm-hmm. From the simple understanding to the most profound truth.
You know, when you say that we don't understand, means we have these limitations in our mind, even at a physical level, if we see, Swami did not have these limitations. And that is what actually draws our attention to. You know, Swami doesn't go to sleep every night. Every night, you know, those students who have stayed with Swami have reported how whole night he would be awake, reading letters, you know. But in the bathroom with a small light on, I think Swami also mentioned that in the last week's conversation when we were having this, that he does that so that others don't get disturbed. So it is not just at a divine level, even at a human level, he has done these things which are stupendous, you know, going for months without proper sleep. When we had done the satsang on Swami's visit to Africa, we saw how Swami traveled all the way and landed there. It was in the night and then again traveled from, I think, Kenya to Uganda, to Kampala, arrived there at 1:30 a.m. or 2 o'clock, 2 in the morning. And there again at 6 o'clock he was out giving darshan. So even physically Swami has done things which are stupendous. And we often admire and are fascinated by that. That's why I think Swami would say that these miracles are just my calling cards. They are sahajam for me. They are ashcharyam for you. Because if you are getting amazed at me not sleeping for 1 month in a row and, you know, reading letters, how can you forget that I am the one who is energizing, activating all the life forms everywhere on planet Earth? You know, we forget that, we take that for granted, and that is why, you know, we look at those things as stupendous miracles. Wow, Swami sleeps only 2 hours a night. Swami, and that too Swami would say that I'll lie down and close my eyes, act as if I'm sleeping so that the others can go to bed. Otherwise, they will not have any time to sleep. Because once they're gone to bed, Swami gets up, he goes to the bathroom, the light is on, the door is closed more than halfway, and he's reading letters. So that also, I'm doing it for your sake. And that we find as stupendous, and what to say of all these. So this is one problem we have. As you said, we extrapolate whatever we are and a little bit more and think Swami is that. We impose our limitations on him, not realizing that he has come to impose his limitless freedom onto all of us, to teach us that that is what you truly are. And that is the reason we think of that. And Swami also hints at the reason as to why it is. It's because we are eternally focused outward, external. Our focus is external, whereas our focus should truly be internal. Because Swami says when your focus is external, you become limited, you have constraints, and you are not able to control stuff. And Swami gives the example, I think he's alluding to the Apollo 1 disaster that took place in 1967, where it was a mission that had been planned for so long and everything had been done with perfection. I think this was an attempt to put man on moon in 1967. Eventually, the Americans managed it in 1969 with Neil Armstrong and Aldrin and Collins. I think these three went. But in 1967, when everything was done to perfection, finally there was a fire. You know, a fire broke out and burnt all the three astronauts in their cabin inside the space shuttle or rocket. So, you know, when you think that you are in control of everything, by an external outlook, you realize that you are in control of nothing. I mean, man we often have the pride of thinking that I control this, you know, this is in my power, I can do this to you, I can do that to you. You know, we often get intoxicated with this false sense of control and power. I remember in one discourse, Swami was saying, you think you are in control, you don't control your own digestion. You are not, the digestive system doesn't wait for your permission to digest the food, it digests. You are not in control of your own heartbeat. And I think when Swami tells us all this, it is in order to make us humble from this external viewpoint, from this wrong dehabhimanam. And at the same time, Swami, next sentence, Swami says that God is not subject to any limitation. He is the creator of the elements, their modifier, their preserver, their destroyer. So, as long as we have this dehabhimana, this attachment to the body, we have to work with the humility that I am just an instrument for that universal force that energizes and activates everything. And from there we have to move on to identifying with that force and then realize that it is the same force in me, in you, in others, everyone, and be able to see divinity in all. I think that is the evolution that the avatar came to set forth and ensure that it happens.
No, absolutely. I think, you know, there are two understandings in this. As this is a question, I think, which has come to many of our minds when we would sit there and, you know, Swami would so leisurely spend time in the portico, walking around, sometimes speaking to the primary school children. Hmm. And there are a lot of people, there's one doctor who was saying that I think he was serving in some country in Africa, where, you know, there was so much of need for medicine, there was so much of need for medical care. Mm. And he was explaining how, you know, there were many, many crisis situations when somebody was dying. And I mean, he would be the only doctor for 200 kilometers radius. Mm. And you had to take care of everything. There's no question of specialization. Mm. Because when they know you as a doctor, they'll call you for everything. Everything from a small cut to probably an organ failure. And you'll have to respond to everything. And he would go there and many, many times, you know, he would say this, that as he's serving there, Swami, instead of standing there in the portico and speaking to all the students, why don't you come and help me here? You know, there's a need here, and the avatar is on earth, and you're spending your time in such chat, right? Mm-hmm. At least this discussion is spiritual. So many discussions that Swami would have standing in the portico is about, you know, what did you have for breakfast? What did you do this? And very, very simple, and you know,
what's happening around the state, exchange, around the country,
right? Yes. So this question would often come. You know, there are two things which would stand out. One is you look at Swami as merely that physical body. You don't talk about Swami's omniscience or anything. The involvement with which Swami would do, right? For all of us, as somebody who, or a teacher or a speaker, this is a great lesson for all of us. You know, we change our energy levels or our involvement based on, you know, how many audience are there in front of us. Mm. 10,000 people listening will be all the more careful. You know, there is a...
And we'll also be all the more charged.
Right, and the important people in the audience will be all the more careful. If there are 2 or 3 people, then, you know, we will be a little more relaxed. The way Swami would operate is not like that. He was always giving his 100%. He might be giving a discourse to an audience of more than 1,000 people. There would be difference in the way Swami would communicate. You would see that a birthday discourse would be very general. You know, it would not be very deep. A summer course discourse, on the other hand, would be very technical and very detailed. That content difference used to be there because Swami is trying to communicate the best, what is necessary. But there'll be no dip in energy. There'll be no dip in involvement.
Absolutely. Right? Not only in the content, there might be some differences even in
analogy,
in the style, you know.
Style, right.
Sometimes it's a very formal style. Sometimes it's very casual. But even when Swami is speaking so casually, the involvement was unbelievable. I mean, that is why we often thought, right, God, you have come down and what are you fretting and fuming about the vada and the chutney, the coconut in it? What on earth is going on? You know, we would be amazed. But that is true. Though the styles may vary, the content may vary, his involvement was always 100%. And that is something we need to emulate.
Right. And that, I think, is the physical learning from the way Swami would interact. The question that his love is asking. But Swami is also saying, you know, never forget that I am not just this body. Right. And probably the hidden statement is, don't credit yourself too much. Right. What I'm giving through this body is only one of the small ways through which I'm able to give myself to an aspirant. Because as I think as people who have lived in Swami's physical presence, or people who crave to live in Swami's physical presence, who feel that they've missed that opportunity, we all think that, you know, Swami has been a little unkind to us, unjust to us. I mean, even as students, we feel that Swami did not give me as much as he gave to that other student. We all get into that because of this block in our mind that Swami was only that physical.
And Swami can give
only through that physical body. And I think that's what Swami is saying, that, you know, I have thousands of heads and thousands of hands, and this is just one pair of hands and one head that you're seeing in front of you. Right? And this is not the only way through which I can give. In every way I give it 100%. I think that's the other example. And I think that it's in that sense Swami is also saying about seeing inward and seeing outward, where the outward is always physical. It's the concrete. There's, you know, you're either here or you're there. You can't be in both places. You're either doing this or you're doing that. And I think all these questions about how come Swami is doing so much and how come Swami is giving so much time comes only in that absolute physical plane where everything is binary. It's there or it's not there. It's here or there. But Swami is saying that don't look at it from that point of view. Look at it even from the spiritual point of view, because you're dealing with a phenomenon which is way beyond physical. And I think that is why that the answer pans from the physical to the esoteric in that sense.
Hislop continues. He says, the avatar is never born, but he appears to take birth in a body which then gradually grows to full size in the ordinary way. The bodies that one sees are impermanent, and Baba does not look to be different. You know, it is like him saying that in spite of all that you say, Swami, at first glance, you are as normal as any other. You have also, the avatar has also taken a body. The avatar also is going through all the travails, difficulties of the body, just as you yourself have said just now. You know, Swami has just himself said that he goes through everything, and that our body also goes to the full size in the ordinary way. Immediately, Swami corrects him, and Swami says, the avatar takes only the body such as you have described. The difference is that men come into bodies with tendencies and the results of actions of, you know, possibly the past births. Baba takes this body without any tendencies, completely free, with no desires or attachments, and is always happy. So this is the classic question that Kasturi had asked, whether Swami's birth was a pravesha or a prasava. Prasava meaning conception like any other child is conceived, and pravesha means entry. And that is when I think Swami directed Professor Kasturi to ask Mother Ishwaramma, who was still alive at that time, as to what had happened. And Mother Ishwaramma narrates how once when she is drawing water from the well, a blue ball of light enters her womb. That makes it very clear that it was an entry. It was not that Swami was conceived. It is not through the union of the man and woman that Swami came, because it was an entry. And, you know, that is the same thing that's highlighted here, that the body of the avatar does not come with past karma, that it is everything that is being that it is undergoing is through the will. It is through the sankalpa of the Lord, and it is not because of past karmas or past actions. And you know, it also becomes very clear when we look at Swami's physical appearance vis-a-vis the physical appearance of all those who are, you know, in court, the family members born in the same family. It is so different. It's almost as if entirely new genetic material has been taken to create. Now, these are all physical and worldly evidences to prove what Swami is stating here, that the avatar takes the body as you have described. It also takes on a role and comes, you know, takes on the body with all the limitations. But the difference is the avatar is always absolutely free. And the avatar comes with the objective of teaching mankind how to win this freedom.
I think in one of Swami's discourses, Swami says this, you know, you think that you're born in this family, you're born to these parents, and it appears like, you know, among the millions of families you could be born in, among the hundreds of countries you could be born in, you happen to, you know, by chance be born in a family in a certain country, in a certain place.
And, in certain circumstances.
Right, and Swami says it's not like that. Seeing every action of yours, good and bad, seeing every account, a very precise birth has been chosen for you. You are born there absolutely precisely. There is no sense of chance at all. And you've been put there for a certain purpose. And Swami, of course, clearly says there are give and takes. you have to repay certain debts to certain people, and all of that is taken into account, and you are given that particular birth, right? And when Swami says that there is nothing like that for me, I do not be born with any tendencies. And of course, Swami also says that all of these karmas form tendencies that become your swabhava, and that's how you're born. And that's the nature with which you're born. And of course, given also the opportunity to change that nature to a certain extent through how you wish to transform your life. And Swami would say, and this is typically what Krishna tells Arjuna, he said, Name Parthasi Kartavyam, there is no
duty.
Karma or duty that binds me in all these three worlds. I have come here, but still even I act, right? That's precisely what Swami has been telling. I take care of the accounts, I take care of the hostels and the hundreds of thousands of rupees that I have to spend and I have to manage and all of that. And then Swami says, I have not born here because there is anything that binds me here, that anything, that tendency that has brought me here. And I mean, I think this is a very, very beautiful answer that Swami is giving. Not that we are anybody to qualify that, but Swami is reminding us that anything that you look at Swami, you should never forget whom you're observing, right? It is not that Swami should not be observed at the physical end. You should learn, because as we said, there is so much there to learn, even from observing Swami in the physical sense, but never to forget whom Swami is at all. As Swami was the very famous interaction, which is often quoted. I think it is Mr. Subbarao, right? Gandikoti Subbarao, who once asked Swami, or it is Dr. Reddy's father, I forgot who it is, who asked Swami about how Swami is able to have so much energy even though Swami eats so little.
And, this was, I think, quoted by Dr. Narendranath Reddy.
Right.
And there's a conversation that
this
he
father,
had with Swami.
I think it is his father, Adivi Reddy, had with Swami, I think.
The dining table.
Right. And he makes the statement, he said, Swami eats so little, but Swami is so energetic and Swami is so active. And then he said that maybe Swami draws his energy
sustenance
directly from the five elements, the Panchabhutas. And instantly Swami shot back at him and Swami said, what nonsense is that? The five elements draw their sustenance from me.
Mm.
Right? And that is just that incident which I quoted of constantly remembering whom you're talking with, even when you're in the worst of crisis. And I think that's what Swami is saying, that you observe me, you learn from me, but never once forget whom you're talking to. It is in what is an avatar, what do you mean by a divine descent? And that should never be forgotten when you're asking these questions.
And so naturally comes the next question from Hislop, when he says, so when one sees Baba as a form amongst all these perishable, impermanent forms, cannot one point to him as the one reality amongst all these perishable dreamlike forms? Because as you said, we should never forget who Swami is. So he's saying, so Swami, therefore, can we look at you as the sole and only reality amongst all the other things which are impermanent? Swami's answer yet again is so beautiful, because Swami says, yes, the one reality is Baba, and immediately qualifies that by saying, Baba means B-A-B-A, which is being, awareness, bliss, and Atma. That reality. So again, you know, it makes it very clear that it is not Baba's body which is the reality, but the occupant of that body, that principle, that being. Because Swami is saying, when you say Baba is the one reality we must focus on, everything else is unreal. Swami is saying, yes, focus on Baba, but what is Baba? B-A-B-A is being, which is Sat, awareness, which is Chit, and bliss, which is Ananda, which are nothing but the, if we can say, the qualities of the Atma. So Swami says, being, awareness, bliss, Atma. This is Baba. This is the reality, the only reality amongst the sea and ocean of unreality or untruth that you see all around.
Right. And I think after this, the question changes a little. The discussion changes to a different theme. So I think we'll take a short break, dear listeners. Don't go away. We'll continue with the questions and answers that we're going through.
Welcome back, dear listeners. We continue with the conversation, and as Prem said, the topic changes a bit over here and it again gets into a very interesting realm. So Hislop says, what did Baba mean about the spiritual rays that comprise a human being being projected into the vastness instead of limited ego? And Swami says, when the world melts away, when there is bliss, or even when there is a temporary feeling of happiness, hold to that state and stay with it and do not allow yourself to fall back into ego, emotions and thoughts. From man comes a series of spiritual rays whose quality is delight and bliss. All man needs to do is manifest that bliss. You know, this is something very practical, something very important. Swami says that, you know, just like the reality is the sun and there are clouds that come and cover the sun every now and then. But in those moments when the clouds part and we are able to see sunlight, we realize the truth. And after that, the next time the cloud comes, I am not so affected because I know that the clouds are not a reality. They are passing clouds. Soon they will go and there will be sun because the sun is the reality. Same way Swami is saying that your reality is ananda. Your reality is to be blissful. And you experience that every now and then. There are those moments when you feel happy and blissful. Knowing that that is your reality, hold on to that. Unfortunately, we hold on to the other things. You know, I remember seeing a talk in which this person was telling so nicely. He was saying, he starts off by telling a joke. You know, he tells a joke. Some random joke it is. And when he tells that joke, everybody laughs. Everybody laughs. And then he continues narrating the same joke. And this time, less number of people laugh because they have just heard that joke 1 minute back. And then he continues and narrates the same joke yet again. Now even less, a few people, they laugh out of courtesy, out of respect because he's a speaker and, you know, we need to show some courtesy. And the fourth time he tells the joke, nobody laughs because possibly everyone is wondering whether this man has gone nuts. What is he doing telling the same joke over and over again? And then, you know, the speaker, he says, have you noticed something very interesting? We cry over the same things over and over again. I go through a bad experience. I get angry. I cry about it. And then I go, relive it, cry about it again. Go to another place, cry over it again. He says, we are ready to cry over the same things over and over again. But we are not ready to laugh at the same joke over and over again. We say, hey, come on, it's the same joke. Why should I laugh again? Then it's the same sorrow. Why are you crying again about it? And Swami is saying over here that change your focus. Instead of holding on to things that make you miserable, sorrowful, sad, and indulging in it over and over again, hold on to those things that make you joyous and keep reliving that joy again and again. You know, when Swami left the physical in 2011, it was definitely a very, very difficult situation. And yes, we felt sorrowful. Now we have a choice. We can either go back to the 24th of April 2011 and keep crying over why did Swami have to leave? What did he do? Now we are gone. We can keep crying over it. Or, like possibly what we are doing, we can go back to so many other hundreds and thousands and millions of memories, relive those and feel the joy. Swami says you should start focusing on happiness because that is your true self. So when there are those moments when that happiness exhibits itself, you exude that happiness, Swami says try to hold on to that, try to extrapolate that, try to elongate that, try to remain in that and ensure that you don't fall back to the other state, because the other state comes because of our ego, our attachment and all that which is false. So Swami actually gives a very, very practical exercise that we can try to implement in our day-to-day lives.
Very true. In fact, the question that Hislop is asking is, as you're saying, it's a very deep and spiritual one. And the answer that Swami is giving is so practical. The question that Hislop is asking comes from, I think, an analogy which Swami would often give. Swami would, I don't know if I'm getting it right, Swami would say, it's like, It's like the theater. When you go to a theater, you have a white screen. The white screen is like Prakriti or Shakti. And Swami would say the light is like Shiva. And it's the play of this light and the screen, or the light falling on the screen, which creates this entire idea of, you know, the world.
The illusion of a movie.
The illusion of the world, the illusion of the many characters. And then Swami would go on to say that imagine the same light, if it floods the hall, you will not see anything. That is in the hall, when they turn on all the lights in a cinema hall, you don't see anything on the screen. Only when the same light passes through the small, opening in the wall, Swami says you see this entire movie. So Swami would say that small hole is actually the ego. When light or divinity shines through your ego, you find all this multiplicity playing out in front of you in the form of Maya. And Swami would say, and I think that is the reference he's making to, he's saying that Baba means by spiritual rays that compress a human being being projected into the vastness instead of the limited ego. It should not be projected through the ego. The answer that Swami is giving is so practical. As you said, Swami says the nature is happiness. Swami would give that example. I think if you have not come across this already in the conversation, I think it comes sometime later. Now, Swami says that, you know, you see a man walking down the road. If he's smiling or if he's having a neutral expression, nobody would come and accost him and ask him anything. But if he's crying, definitely somebody will stop and ask what happened, what is wrong with you, right? Uh-huh. Because Swami says that that's an unnatural state, and that's why people want to know. Nobody will come and question a natural state. So that's why Swami says that bliss and happiness is natural. That's what you are. And when the problem with us is there are only few openings through which we experience that, as we had seen even in the last week's discussion. There's something that, some experiences that we like, some things which are pleasant, and we are able to feel that happiness and bliss only through those experiences. Swami says, when you find those moments of happiness and bliss, can you elongate that? Can you extend that? Can you hold on to that? Right? And that's the whole challenge. It's not that we don't have ways of becoming happy in the world, but we don't have ways by which we can sustain that happiness and make that eternal eventually. I think that's the whole idea. And Swami is saying that practically that's what you'll have to try to do. Don't run after 100 things that can make you happy. Find out the way by which that you can sustain that happiness, even if there's only one thing or one event that has made you happy.
You know, when you were saying about the natural state, it's so true. You know, if you have a baby at home, the babies, you know, babies have this ability to laugh and smile for no reason. And when they're doing that, nobody asks actually, why is the baby smiling? They just enjoy the baby smiling. But if the baby is crying, you know, even though sometimes the reason is known, it is lunchtime, it's hungry and the baby is crying, still people ask why it's crying. So it is so natural that unconsciously we believe that smiling is natural, crying is not. Crying is not our swabhava, crying is not our nature. Being sad is not our nature. That's the reason we ask somebody why they are sad. We don't, if somebody is happy or normal, we just don't ask anything at all. Swami continues. Swami says, the idea of search is an error. You know, because we say that it's the pursuit of happiness. We are searching for happiness. That's an error. It's wrong. It's foolishness, because you yourself are that happiness. You know, Swami is saying the idea of search itself is an error. Everybody already knows the truth. All that is needed is to put that truth into practice and to manifest it. The humanity of man is just these spiritual rays of delight. It is very easy to crush a flower or to wink an eye. And Swami says, self-realization is as easy as that. You know? And if, you know, continuing, this is not what Swami is saying, but I am just saying that if we have faith that Swami is God, if we have faith that He is the most wise, most powerful, most loving in the whole universe, then we have to believe it. It is as easy. It's just that we feel, no, it is very tough. I can't do it. No, I am not like this. We again put in more limitations. When Swami says, you are not having these limitations, let go of the limitations, we hold on and we say, no, this is what we are. And how many times has this not happened where Swami tells us to do bhajans, we are ready to do. Swami tells, go and do that, we are ready to do. But Swami tells, you are divine and so am I. I am divine and so are you. No, Swami, how can we be divine? You know, even if we sit and don't negate it verbally or vocally in His presence, in our mind and hearts, we repel that idea. No, I am not divine. I am not divine. And yet, we behave like hypocrites and we say, yes, Swami is divine, but what he says, I don't accept. Swami says, you are divine. He says, no, how can I be divine? I cannot. Swami says, you are embodiment of love. You are supposed to, means you are an epitome of love. You love everyone. No, how can I love everyone? It's not possible. So, which is true? Do I believe Swami is God and whatever he says is truth? Or do I feel that I am simply being hypocritical and telling he is God because I believe what I wish? So Swami is saying, the truth is that you are that bliss and joy. So hold on to that. And Swami says, it's very easy. It's very easy when we have 100% faith. It is so easy. You know, the other day, because my daughter was refusing to eat food, I said, if you don't eat food, then such and such a thing, you know, built up some scary scenario and said, is going to come now and eat, not eat you up, I mean, is going to come now. Oh, she got scared, she ate it up. You know, that is the kind of faith a child has in the parent. You know that even if I make a fantastically unbelievable kind of story, they believe it to be true. If I don't eat food, the morning sunrise won't happen. Oh, it is true. You know, that kind of faith we need to exhibit in God. I just felt that, you know, when I saw that, wow, how trusting you are. The child is so trusting that I am scared that I don't want to tell anything. Next time I'll be careful in what I tell because the child is believing whatever I say. I mean, can we make Swami experience the same? That, you know, whatever I say, whatever I do, this person is going to believe. This, because that is the kind of faith they have. But every time when there's an opportunity to exhibit that faith, I think we fail miserably. So when that faith is there, it becomes so easy to get self-realization. It is as easy as crushing a flower or, as Swami says, winking an eye.
Right. And I think the important practical tip that Swami is giving there, I think it's a very, very important thing. And Swami has mentioned this elsewhere also. Mm. Again, it's a very important topic even in some of the Upanishads, where they say that you know what is right and wrong. There is absolutely no one who does not know. Mm. You know what is right and wrong. You know what is your true nature. And Swami speaks here about happiness and he says truth. The only problem is the hesitation in following that. And Swami says the only solution to that is do it whenever you get the opportunity. Mm. When you know what is right and wrong, the more you follow what is right, the more you will express it. There's nothing to be found. There is nothing to be sought and received. That the idea of searching for something itself is wrong, Swami says. Mm. It's all about only manifesting it. How often you manifest it, so often you become, so easily you get established in that. And it is not even like, it's not a linear progression in that sense. Yes, last year I expressed it 100 times and this time I have to go up to 120 times. It's not even like that. It's not like how often you're able to do it or how many times you've made the right choice. It happens much, much more swiftly than that from what Swami is saying, because he's saying that it's as easy as winking an eye. And as they would say, we would often think, I think this again is Swami's analogy, this room which has been dark for 20 years, we think that it's going to take as many years for it to brighten up. Hmm. And it's not that. 20 years of darkness can be lifted off by just at one switch. It just takes that 1 second. When you get the right light, everything goes. It's not that the 20 years of baggage has to be removed over 20 years or 15 years or anything like that.
It's like in a dark room, I'm searching for the switch.
Right.
It may take me so much time to find the switch. Doesn't mean that it'll take that much time for it to get light, because the moment the switch is found, it only means we have to continue with the efforts, keep putting in efforts, and one day it'll happen. If somebody asks me, again, because of my own life situation, if my child asks me, when will I learn how to balance a cycle, bicycle, I have no idea. But all that I can say is, you keep trying, one day it'll just come. And once it comes, trust me, all your life you'll never forget it. Once you learn how to balance a bicycle, irrespective of whether it's a crowded road or it's a bumpy road, whatever it is, you will never forget it. But when it'll come, I have no idea. You have to keep trying. You'll fall to the left, you'll fall to the right. Keep trying. One day you'll get it. You know, possibly to conclude today's satsang, we can quickly take the next two statements, you know, the question that Hislop asks and the answer that Swami gives, because again, it is so insightful. You know, I think if we can even just treasure this, laminate and keep this in our lives, it should be enough. Hislop says, Swami said that it is man's duty to be happy. And Swami says, happiness is essential for God realization. It is one of the major gates to divinity. It is not just a fault if a person is not happy. It is one of the most serious of all faults. It is a barrier to realization. Mostly people are unhappy because of worldly pursuits, attachments, and enjoyments. Too much interested in the world. To get free of this fault, a person has to be told of the seriousness of this fault. He should realize that desire is never ending, like the waves of the sea. I think this is such a, mantra in fact. Swami says, if you are not happy, you are not going to get God realization. You cannot struggle, strive and sorrow your way to God realization. God realization begins by being happy. And Swami says, this statement, he says, it is not just a fault if a person is not happy. It is the most serious of faults. In the spiritual path, not being happy is the most serious of faults because, as Swami says, it's a barrier to realization. And all this happens, again Swami says, mostly people are unhappy because of worldly pursuits, attachments and enjoyments. Dependence on what is outside for my happiness. Then you will end up being unhappy because, as Swami says, the world by its nature is impermanent. Nothing can give you permanent happiness. So when Swami, again, the way Hislop asks also is so significant because he says that Swami says it's man's duty to be happy. It's his kartavya. It is his duty. It's not a right. It's not a choice. It is your duty to be happy.
Swami would often explain this in relation to the three gunas. Swami would say that, somebody who is pursuing happiness, even a worldly person, even somebody who is saying that I want to become rich, I want to become successful or famous, Swami would often say that is a quality of rajas, right? So somebody who is in that quality of rajas can be taken to sattva, to be told that no, don't strive for this, or there's something higher and there's something greater to be achieved. You can take somebody who is in rajas to sattva, but somebody who is in tamas cannot be taken to sattva. And Swami would say somebody who is despondent, somebody who is low, somebody who is criticizing themselves and saying that, I cannot do anything. Typically, the situation Arjuna was in. And Swami would say that is why the first thing that Krishna did was he made Arjuna angry. He shouted at him and he called him, all the wrong names that he would not like to be called by anyone. So that at least then he will come to rajas, and from rajas you can always take him to sattva. So Swami very beautifully says that why would Krishna, who knows the purity from which Arjuna's cries were coming, would say such things to Arjuna? It's because when somebody is in tamas, you will never get even the sadbuddhi, or the good advice will never enter your head. So he makes him angry, calls him wrong words, and abuses him so much, so to say, verbally. And then he gets angry and he says, how can you call me these things? And then Arjuna gets the discourse from Krishna. And Swami would say that that's why that happiness is so much essential. In fact, I think we have done one satsang, if I'm not wrong, where we said, what is the one thing that Swami expects from us? And as a conclusion to that, we came to this. If there is anything that Swami wants from us, it's only that Swami wants us to be happy. And I think if there is one thing that we need to strive for, forget about self-realization, even if we think that I want to offer Swami something, I think this is what it is. And I think it's a beautiful point to conclude this week's episode.
Yeah, just as an add-on, Swami himself says in that song, Love is My Form, he says, bliss is my food. Let us remember that every moment we are not happy, we are starving Swami. If we say we love Swami, we have to feed Swami. The basic minimum we do is to feed Swami. And what do we feed him? He himself has said, bliss is my food. So, even as you said, forget all the other things. The simplest thing is to be happy, to spread happiness. Even to spread happiness first, we have to be happy. Like it is said, if you want to help a beggar and give a dollar to him or her, you need to first have $10 or $100. If you yourself don't have, how on earth, isn't it foolishness to go and try to give some money to a beggar? In the same way, if you want to spread happiness around, first you have to be the center of positivity and happiness. And Swami says that if you're not happy, you're not even going to get moksha. You're not going to get self-realization. Nothing is going to come because this is your true nature, and moksha is nothing but complete, constant, integrated awareness of your true nature, which is bliss. So if, forget constant, forget integrated, even if there is no awareness of our nature being bliss, where do we achieve the ultimate? So on that note, dear listeners, we will bring this Thursday's afternoon satsang to a close. As always, we are grateful to Bhagwan for this wonderful opportunity to sit and think about him and go through his works. As always, you can write to us with your thoughts, your feedback, your suggestions, whatever, to listener@radiosai.org. And on that note, we will conclude on the other side of the satsang. You will be greeted by Brother Chandu with his segment, Love to Love.
Partiburi Charini Palayama.
Shini.
Nitya